Good day, this is Greg, and I'll be reading the Vermilion County News for Tuesday, September 15th, 2020. And we'll start with the front page of the commercial news. The first story today is entitled, District 118, Westville, Deal with COVID Cases. And this is by Carol Rome. Danville. Danville District 118 Superintendent Alicia Gaddis announced late Monday afternoon she was temporarily closing Liberty Elementary School after a school employee exhibited symptoms of COVID-19. "We had to close it for this week to clean it and also until we have more information," she said. In a letter Gaddis sent to parents on Monday afternoon, she said, "We do not believe students were within close contact of this employee." 69 in-person learning students at Liberty School will participate in a remote learning program the rest of this week and return to the classroom on September 21st. In the meantime, district officials will work directly with the Vermilion County Health Department and Liberty School will be cleaned and disinfected, Gaddis said. Also on Monday, all of the students at Judith Jacoma Elementary School in Westville have switched to remote learning for the next 2 weeks after an individual at the school tested positive for COVID-19. In-person learning has been suspended for 2 weeks, Westville Superintendent Seth Miller said on Monday. "We became aware we had a positive test result," he said. "We worked with the Vermilion County Health Department with contact tracing, and people with close proximity of the individual were contacted. We have specific seating charts in the classrooms and on the buses," Miller said. The district sent a message Sunday night to Judith Jacoma parents informing them that an additional had tested positive for the virus. "The school has one case that I know of," Miller said, adding, "It's not the same individual as before." At the end of August, district officials decided to keep Judith Jacoma Elementary School open after a positive COVID-19 case was reported. "Each case is unique," Miller explained. "It depends on how many people were affected and what key role they played." The tentative date to resume in-person learning is September 28th, he said. The students at Westville High School and Westville Junior High School will continue to attend in-person classes unless they opted for remote learning before the start of the school last month. In Hupston, more than a dozen Hupston area high school students who have been remote learning while in quarantine since September 4th are expected to return to the classroom by the end of the week. "There were 15 or 16 kids we had to exclude from school, and they're doing online learning," Superintendent Robert Richardson said Monday. "We should have everyone back in class by the end of the week." As soon as district officials were made aware that a student had tested positive for the virus, Richardson said, "We worked with the Vermilion County Health Department and did contact tracing. We got a seating chart and contacted students around the kid." Richardson said the district remains vigilant in checking student and staff temperatures and inquiring about symptoms so everyone remains safe while at school. Since the beginning of the school year in August, for most Vermilion County schools, positive COVID-19 cases have prompted three districts, Salt Fork, Oakwood, and Westville, to suspend in-person learning and switch to remote learning. Monday was the first day back at school for all of Salt Fork High School's students who have been remote learning for the past 2 weeks, including 29 students who are in quarantine after possibly coming in contact with a few students who tested positive for COVID-19 last month. Oakwood Grade School closed temporarily on August 31st for 3 days with all students learning remotely from home because of a positive case. Next, also from the front page, we have a story, a staff report entitled, "Kiwanis Partners with McDonald's for Pancake Event." Danville. When the public thinks of Danville Noon Kiwanis, many think of pancakes. Danville Noon Kiwanis has been known for its annual Pancake Day fundraiser for several years. This is a community event that many look forward to each October. While the traditional Pancake Day won't be taking place this year at the David S. Palmer Arena, there still will be a pancake event. Danville Noon Kiwanis is grateful to be partnering with Vermilion County McDonald's to make Pancake Day happen. This year, a $6 ticket will get you a hotcakes and sausage meal with a small drink of orange juice, milk, soft drink, or coffee. Purchasers can redeem their ticket at any of the six Vermilion County McDonald's locations from October 12th through October 16th. On Thursday, October 15th, Kiwanis members will be on site to greet patrons. We could not do this without the generous support of our sponsors. Even though this year looks a little different than years past, we are so very grateful to have the opportunity to partner with Vermilion County McDonald's, said Natalie Duncan, president of Danville Noon Kiwanis. Kiwanis President-elect Mary Supernant said, "Kiwanis has been giving an amazing opportunity, and we want to ask the community to help spread the word. Last year, we were able to give over $20,000 to various local organizations because of our one-day event and generous donors, such as PepsiCo. This year, with our partnership with our local McDonald's, despite the circumstances, we have an entire week to help us reach our goal." Travis Maines, Kiwanis Lieutenant Governor of the INI District and past President of Danville Noon Kiwanis, said, "We really had to think outside the box on this one. Those first few Pancake Day committee meetings were tough. We were left scratching our heads. What were we going to do? I'm proud of this group and thankful we were able to find a way to still make this event work so that we can continue to serve the children in our community. We are very excited for the opportunity to partner with Danville Noon Kiwanis for their Pancake Day event," said Deanna Witzel, owner of Vermilion County of McDonald's. "We are looking forward to safely serving thousands of people and helping Kiwanis raise money for our community." The annual Kiwanis Pancake Day started in 1956. Between 3,500 and 4,000 tickets are sold for this one-day event. Last year, with the support of sponsors, volunteers, and pancakes, Danville Noon Kiwanis distributed more than $23,000 to 30-plus local charities that support children in Vermilion County. The group has consistently raised more than $20,000 each year during the last 10 years, and it has more than 50 members, many having been in the club for decades. The annual fundraiser has continued to give back to the local community year after year. Danville Noon Kiwanis is celebrating its 100th year this year as a Kiwanis International Club. Next, we have another staff report article, and this one is entitled, "Police Seek Information in Weekend Shooting." Danville. Danville police are investigating a weekend shooting that injured two people. About 2:42 a.m. Saturday, Danville police responded to the OSF emergency room for a report of two victims being treated for gunshot wounds. Upon arrival, officers spoke with the victims, who were identified as a 20-year-old Danville man with a gunshot wound to his arm and a 27-year-old Chicago man with a gunshot wound to his back. The victims stated they were walking in the area of the 300 block of Bradley Lane when someone started shooting at them from an unknown location. The victims fled the area and got a ride to the hospital for treatment. No other injuries were reported during this incident, and no suspect information is currently available. The investigation continues, and no other information is being released at this time. Anyone who has information regarding this incident is asked to call Danville Police at 431-2250 or call Vermilion County Crime Stoppers at 446-TIPS. And we have a number of obituaries today, so we're going to turn to that next. And the first is for Lonnie Dennis Corson. Lonnie Dennis Corson, 65, of Danville, passed away at 10:44 p.m. September 10, 2020, at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana, Illinois. A celebration of life service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, September 18, 2020, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville at 3940 North Vermilion Street. J. Sorrell will officiate. Burial will be in Sunset Memorial Park. Visitation will be held on Thursday, September 17, 2020, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home, with Masonic rites accorded at 7 p.m. following visitation. It is kindly requested that those in attendance of the visitation or service wear a mask and practice social distancing. Memorials may be made in Lonnie's memory to the American Heart Association or the Autism Community in Action, or TACA. Alberta Cessna. Alberta M. Cessna, 95, of Oakwood, Illinois, passed away at 11:45 p.m. on Friday, September 11, 2020, at North Logan Healthcare Center in Danville. A funeral service will be at 1:30 p.m. Wednesday, September 16th, at Robison Chapel in Catlin, Illinois, with Chris Lawler officiating. Burial will be in Oakwood Cemetery in Oakwood. Visitation is from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, September 15th, at Robison Chapel. Memorials in her memory may be made to the Alzheimer's Association. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, face masks will be required for entry to the visitation and the funeral. Betty Jean Kruger. Betty Jean Kruger, 86, of Petersburg, Indiana, passed away at 2:32 p.m. on Sunday, September 13, 2020, at Autumn Trace in Attica, Indiana. Funeral services will be at 1 p.m. Wednesday, September 16, 2020, at Dickerson Funeral Home in Petersburg, with Pastor Garland Pennell officiating. Visitation will begin at 11 a.m. on Wednesday and continue until Order of Eastern Star service at 12:45 p.m. Burial will be at Mount Hope Cemetery in Covington. The family would appreciate face masks to be worn during the visitation due to COVID-19. Phyllis Wilson. Phyllis J. Yoho Wilson, 87, of Cuyahoga, passed away on Wednesday, September 9, 2020, at Clinton Gardens. Cremation was chosen, with a memorial service planned at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be given to the Cuyahoga Fire Department at 105 South Logan Street, Cuyahoga, Indiana, 47928. Sanders Funeral Care has been entrusted with care. Curtis Dawes. Curtis Wayne Dawes, 71, of Catlin, passed away at 10:52 p.m. on Friday, September 11, 2020, at his home. A celebration of Wayne's life will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, September 16, 2020, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville at 3940 North Vermilion Street. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Wednesday prior to his service at the funeral home. He will be laid to rest in Sunset Memorial Park in Danville. It is kindly requested that face masks be worn and social distancing is practiced by those in attendance of the visitation and/or service. Memorial donations may be given in his name to the Humane Society, Vermilion County Animal Shelter, or Wounded Warrior Project. Judith A. Cureton. Judith A. Cureton, 72, of Danville, passed away at 7:10 p.m. Thursday, September 10, 2020, at the Waters of Covington. Per her wishes, Judith was cremated, and there are no services at this time. Her family was assisted by Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Georgetown. Betty Williford. Betty Williford, 89, of Gifford, passed away at 10:34 p.m. Wednesday, September 2, 2020, at Country Healthcare and Rehab in Gifford. Per her wishes, she will be cremated and later laid to rest in Forest Park Cemetery in Georgetown. Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Georgetown assisted her family with arrangements. Deborah K. Hayes. Deborah K. Hayes, 67, of Danville, passed away at her home at 8:40 a.m. on September 9, 2020. A celebration of life service will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, September 18, 2020, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center at 3940 North Vermilion Street in Danville. Robbie Ketchside will officiate. Burial will be in Johnson Cemetery. Visitation will be held on Thursday, September 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. It is kindly requested that those in attendance of the visitation or service wear a mask and practice social distancing. Memorials may be made in Deborah's memory to the charity of the donor's choice. Robert Arthur Shoup. Robert or Bob Arthur Shoup, 75, of Westfield, Indiana, passed away on Friday, September 11, 2020, at St. Vincent's Hospice of Indianapolis, Indiana. Visitation will be at Flanner Buchanan, Zionsville, Indiana, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday, September 15th. Burial will follow at 2 p.m. Eastern at Salem Cemetery in Zionsville, Indiana. Mary Jane Wilkinson. Mary Jane Wilkinson, 90, passed away on Sunday, September 13, 2020, in Danville, Illinois. Visitation will be held on Friday, September 18th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, September 19th, at Emmanuel Lutheran Church at 1930 North Bowman Avenue in Danville, Illinois. Interment will be held at Lutheran Cemetery at a later date. Memorial donations may be made in Mary Jane's name to Emmanuel Lutheran School Library in celebration of her love of reading and lifelong learning. Barbara R. Edmonds. Barbara Regina Edmonds, 86, of Danville, passed away at 4:14 p.m. on Saturday, September 5th, 2020, at her home. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m. on Tuesday, September 15th, at Rossville Cemetery, with Pastor George Desmond officiating. Memorials may be made to the Danville Humane Society. The family has entrusted the Blurton Funeral Home to assist them in honoring Barbara's life. Colleen A. Clark. Colleen A. Clark, 62, of Danville, died at 7:21 p.m. Saturday, September 12th, at home. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Rort Vet Funeral Services, 3 South Hodge Street in Tilton. And that ends the obituaries for today, September 15th. We'll return to the commercial news for some other stories. This next one is a Capital News Illinois report by Jerry Nowicki entitled Statewide COVID Rate Declines Over Weekend. Springfield. The COVID-19 test positivity rate fell to 3.6% statewide on Monday, decreasing in two regions that have faced increased economic restrictions due to high rates. The positivity rate decreased 0.3 of a percentage point since Friday, as the state reported an average of 46,471 test results and 1,652 new cases each day between Saturday and Monday. That made for a three-day positivity rate of about 3.6%. The seven-day rolling positivity rate average is as low as it's been since July 25th, while Region 7 and Region 4 of the state's reopening plan each saw decreases to their positivity rate as of Friday, September 11th. Region 7, which includes Will and Kankakee counties, saw the seven-day average positivity rate decrease to 7.2%, which is still above the 6.5% threshold that will allow the rollback of some economic restrictions. Currently, the region is closed to indoor dining and bar services at restaurants and bars. Region 4, which includes the Metro East area on the Missouri border near St. Louis, saw its rolling positivity rate decrease to 9.4%, marking three straight days of decreases. Other regions ranged from 2.4% in eastern Illinois to 6.7% in Region 9, which includes McHenry and Lake counties in northern Illinois. The Illinois Department of Public Health reported 41 deaths from Saturday to Monday, pushing the total casualty count to 8,314 since the pandemic first reached Illinois. There have been 262,744 confirmed cases among nearly 4.7 million tests completed. The recovery rate for those 42 days removed from a positive diagnosis is 96%, according to IDPH. At the end of Sunday, there were 1,431 persons hospitalized with COVID-19 in Illinois, including 334 in intensive care units and 131 on ventilators. The numbers remain slightly above their pandemic lows and are significant decreases from Friday. Also on Monday, the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority announced the release of more than $8 million to 11 organizations that are involved in communities disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. The funding came from the U.S. Bureau of Justice as part of a federal coronavirus supplemental program. Community-level data on positive COVID-19 cases, unemployment, housing, and reentry was considered in funding decisions, according to a news release. The largest grant totaled $1.4 million and went to The Network, which advocates against domestic violence. Other grants went to the Children's Advocacy Center of Illinois, the Cook County Sheriff's Office for Reentry Housing, the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and others. The Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority is a state agency created in 1983 to improve the administration of criminal justice. And now we have an opinion piece by syndicated columnist Kathleen Parker. And her column today is entitled, What Woodward Owed the Public. Though they might not admit it, journalists who began their careers in the wake of Watergate often ask themselves, what would Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein do? Today that question is more focused. What would I do if I were Bob Woodward? Thanks to taped recordings of interviews Woodward conducted with the president in preparation for his latest book, Rage, the world has learned that President Donald Trump was well aware of the virus's lethality and its method of transmission as early as February. It is also clear that the legendary reporter sat on that story until the week before his book was published. Trump's remarks, now exhaustively replayed, confirm that he knew, as presumably did others in his administration, that the novel coronavirus was an airborne infectious disease and that it was far more lethal than the regular flu. Nevertheless, over several weeks and months, as the virus progressed across the United States, the president continued to downplay concerns about the virus in public, saying it was no worse than the regular flu and failing to create a plan to contain the virus. Downplay is an essential word in the context of the Woodward interviews. In one recording from March, Trump admitted to downplaying the virus and wanted to continue downplaying it because he didn't want people to panic. Today, this is the crux of a dilemma for both Trump and Woodward. Are they guilty in different ways of contributing to about 190,000 American deaths through a conspiracy of silence? Trump may well have wished to avoid a national panic in the early stages of the pandemic, but his silence signals an underlying distrust of his fellow countrymen. Our history is filled with examples of Americans rallying to a cause, no matter how frightening. One can't help wondering how many lives might have been spared with a strong dose of truth and the nobility of purpose of which we're capable as a nation. One also wonders whether Woodward, by withholding news of the president's withholding, may have added to the COVID-19's punch. At the very least, public knowledge of what the president knew but would not say might have forced Trump and others to act on reality rather than some imaginary scenario in which COVID-19 would just disappear one day, as Trump once said, with a wand-like wave of his hand. It would be unfair to suggest, if some have, that the two men are equally at fault. One is the president and took an oath to faithfully execute his duties. But in an interview about his reporting process with the Washington Post's Margaret Sullivan, Woodward's explanation for waiting because he knew his book would be published before the election falls short of satisfying. Woodward also told Sullivan that in February he wasn't yet sure Trump was telling the truth, always a valid concern. It is good to remember that this is not just any reporter. This is Bob Woodward, the man who met Deep Throat in parking garages and knocked on people's doors in the middle of the night for clues to the Watergate burglary. Remember the operative question. What did the president know, and when did he know it? Normally, what a president says he knows is news. With Trump, that linkage has never been reliable. Woodward pointed out to Sullivan that he's no longer a daily reporter, but an author. This means that he has ultimate authority over his research. Although no longer technically employed by the Post, he maintains an honorary associate editor title, which is to say no one wants to criticize an icon who brought fame to the paper for which they proudly toil. Trump, never lacking in self-confidence, really believed that talking to Woodward often without staff present would make the book more positive. Many of the conversations reportedly took place at night by phone when Trump thought of something he thought Woodward might like to hear. What would you or I have done if we were Woodward? I do know I would have sought the counsel of my newspaper editors, which Woodward no longer has. Sometimes being the captain of one's own ship is a windward proposition. It seems clear now that revealing the president's calculated deceptions sooner might have forced Trump to act earlier and led more Americans to take greater precautions. Given that, I think I know what many editors would have advised him. Publish, lest others perish. And finally, from the Community Briefs section, the Curtis G. Redden American Legion Post 210 will be closed this week for deep cleaning and will reopen on Saturday, September 19th. Breakfast will be served from 8:15 to 11 a.m. on Sunday, September 21st. And that takes us to the end of our time for today, Tuesday, September 15th, 2020. My name is Greg. This has been the Vermilion County News, and it's been a pleasure to read for you. I hope you have a great day and stay safe. Take care.